Hello and welcome. I'm Cassie McCullough and this is The List on RN Summer, our weekly stroll about the observation deck, surveying all things popular culture and TV. In just a moment, we're catching a slow boat to Norway, where the most unlikely television genre has been steadily gaining popularity. And a little later, the enduring fascination with Charles Manson. We'll talk to the creator of a podcast about Manson's influence on popular culture and its influence on him. Well, it's been said that the current state of reality TV in Australia is so dire that watching grass grow or paint dry may, in fact, actually be more interesting. Well, the Norwegians are way ahead of us on this. You've probably heard of slow TV. It's a new kind of reality television experience that kicked off in Norway in 2009, when a 7-hour and 16-minute train journey from Bergen to Oslo was broadcast by the Norwegian Broadcasting Corporation.
Vi kjører inn til Arna stasjon. We are now approaching Arna station.
1.2 million people tuned in at least one point, which is not bad given that Norway's population is only about 5 million. Since then, slow TV has proved it's no flash in the pan. It's become a serious phenomenon. Follow-ups such as A Trip Down the Norwegian Coast, National Firewood Night, National Knitting Night have all become permanent fixtures on the television calendar and watched by millions. But it doesn't end there. Last month, the BBC announced it's following suit and has commissioned 3 slow TV programs. So what on earth have the Norwegians tapped into? Espen Utreberg is a professor of media and communication at the University of Oslo, and he joins us now from Oslo. Welcome, Espen.
Thank you.
Now, describe Bergen's Barnen minute for minute for us, because it wasn't just one camera looking over the train driver's shoulder.
No, there were a number of cameras in the train and a small production unit as well. So in addition to the main cameras, which provided you views from the driver's seat forward and to the sides, there were intermittent small sequences with mainly with interviews with people traveling. The interviews had a very kind of an everyday feel, you know, chatting with people on the way. But of course, the bulk of the broadcast was real-time images of the view from the train.
Which we should say is absolutely stunning. I mean, it's stunning imagery.
Oh, yeah.
It's not as if you're just looking out at empty fields or suburban backlocks or industrial sites.
It's also a kind of a heartland of Norway. You pass the mountains between the largest and the second largest cities. So this is a landscape that means a lot to Norwegians, one that kind of resonates with lots of what's common to us historically and culturally.
In 2011, along came another trip after the smashing success of the train trip. And this was also epic in scale, and it smashed the Guinness Book of Records for the world's longest documentary. Tell us about Hurtigruten minute for minute.
The Hurtigruten is a coastal liner which traverses most of the Norwegian coastline, or at least large parts of it, and includes the most famous and scenic fjord parts. And it takes like a week each way, more or less. The way that the train connected Norway overland, this liner did the same for the coastal areas. And it's a kind of a legend there. I mean, I grew up myself in North Norway, and the sound of the tooting Hurtigruta in the afternoon was this fixture, this regular reminder of the coast and of the larger world. And it was as such that it was used also in this TV format.
So over something like 6 days and 134 hours, I think, the journey of the boat down the coast was followed by cameras. I think it was more sophisticated this time, 12 cameras on board, including one fixed to the bow, which could move about.
Yeah.
What was extraordinary was the response from the people of Norway as it came down.
What happened with the Hurtigruta broadcast was it became a kind of an occasion for public gathering, and larger and larger crowds would appear. More and more people waving, more and more people with flags, more and more people, kind of interestingly, using the broadcast to hold up placards saying stuff like "Happy birthday, Mum." So they actually used the broadcast to communicate with each other. You know, as the thing progressed, there were like marching bands when the boat arrived, and mayors, and you know, it became this festive event where, you know, half the town was gathered.
This is a total reimagining of television. In a way, it's very radical. The popularity, though, sort of reveals that it's connecting to a very common hunger, like a very broad need or delight or something. Yeah. Have you got any theories about what it satisfies?
There's something about this genre that kind of reminds you of how condensed and hectic and in-your-face other mainstream television is. The international diet of television in competitive, mature markets is very similar from country to country, but it's a product just of the fact that these are very competitive markets that kind of vie for a type of public interest that impels TV people to try and deliver loads of action and very condensed narratives. The result is kind of samey. The fact that this is something else kind of throws an interesting light back on the rest of the stuff that we're offered. It's just the slowness. It's a very simple thing, you know. It's just a genre that has become very diverse. But the common denominator is take it easy, let stuff unfold in real time, let go of the thought that you have to produce some in-your-face moment or narrative all the time.
So it's a relaxation, it's escape from the fast-paced world, it's a communing with others. That does seem to be quite an important part of it, as well as reaffirming some aspects of cultural identity. And I know that Thomas Hellam, who's one of the producers who has worked on these productions, I guess, events, he says that it taps into a Norwegian love of nature. That's something that came through very strongly for him. Do you think it is a Norwegian thing?
Yeah, it would be kind of weird to say that Norwegians are unique in that we really appreciate nature. That would be kind of strange. There is certainly a love of nature here, and there's a love of traditional life. Of course, you have that in all sorts of places. In Norway, there's also a very strong tradition of various kinds of trekking, of being in nature as an everyday thing and just as a matter of routine. So I would emphasize more the everydayness of contact with nature, which just has to do with the fact that the country is mostly rocks, and there's really lots of it, and just 5 million people.
Now, obviously, the success has been followed up with a number of others, and I mentioned there was Knitting Night, where wool was followed from the sheep's back to be made into a jumper. Another night, there was National Firewood Night, and that was about the best way to chop wood, stack wood, light a fire, and then, of course, the delight of a fire itself. Salmon swimming upstream. What was it like to watch these things?
Oh, I personally enjoy it enormously. But of course, it's very different as for any genre. Some like it, some don't. I enjoy them a little bit like I would enjoy a nice view when I was like out on a Sunday or actually on the boat myself. And indeed, I have traveled a lot with Hurtigruta. It's a it's a landscape that means something to me. It has something familiar to it in addition to something beautiful. So you can have a meetup with your own experiences and your own history and the landscapes that mean something to you. The whole notion that you're watching grass grow is just like, I understand the quip, I understand the initial reaction, but it doesn't really grasp what's interesting here. I'm not enormously keen on the flag waving and the occasion making. When you sit down and you take your time and you start looking at what seems still, everything turns out to be a million small movements of color and shading and small things happening with the wind. And the whole notion that this is boring is just an initial thing. And that's it insofar as there are deeper lessons here. There's something there.
Some people would say that this is not exactly new. In fact, Andy Warhol did this a couple of times. One notable one is his slow movie Sleep from 1963, yeah, which showed the poet John Giono sleeping for 5 hours and 20 minutes. And I know there's been a tradition with this with train journeys as well, and I've even heard recordings on record of famous train journeys across the UK. So it does have a history. Is it, in a way, a utilisation of an older form?
Oh, definitely. It's really interesting that one of the first things that people with cameras did was they went somewhere far away and they just started the camera and they rolled. Perhaps they did kind of a slow panoramic movement from left to right, but essentially much of it was this very stately, slow documentation of somewhere really interesting and somewhere significant but far off that you could sort of take back and show people. So we're kind of touching on something very basic that has to do with recording reality as moving images and showing them.
Now the phenomenon is being tested in other markets. British Airways has apparently made the 7-hour train trip available in flight. And as I mentioned, the BBC is doing its own version. BBC 4 goes slow. They've commissioned a 2-hour canal boat journey down one of Britain's historic waterways. Also a 3-hour journey behind the scenes of the National Gallery. And then several 30-minute ones of celebrating traditional crafts, the making of a chair, of a classic steel knife, etc. This is very similar to what you guys have been up to.
Oh, yeah. Of course, the Norwegian media writes a lot about this currently because we're a small country and it's not really often that anyone else pays attention. Certainly when it comes to television, we've always been importers of ideas and very, very seldom have we been exporters of anything that has to do with television. The Travel Channel in the US has picked up some of this as well. And certainly the international interest in this phenomenon is unlike anything really that I can remember of Norwegian television and its relation to the world.
This is an extraordinary expression of a national cultural imagination, and thank you so much for explaining some of it to us, Espen.
My pleasure. It's amazing that people that far away take an interest. We enjoy this in Norway.
Well, I think we may well enjoy it here. That's Espen Rytrudberg. He's a professor of media and communication at the University of Oslo with a research interest in television and television development. And for the record, we asked ABC TV management and, as yet, no plans. I'm Cassie McCullough and you're listening to The List on RN Summer. Carina Longworth is the creator of You Must Remember This, a popular podcast about the secret and or forgotten histories of Hollywood in the 20th century. Last year we spoke to her about a special series she had recently started called Charles Manson's Hollywood.
Of course, it's the story of the 60s and of how the utopian promise of the civil rights movement and the peace and love ambitions of the hippies curdled amidst a series of disasters. The Manson murders were preceded by the assassinations of Martin Luther King and both Kennedys, the election of Richard Nixon, and the worsening situation in Vietnam, all events which were branded by someone as the death knell to the 60s.
Karina Longworth, welcome to Radio National, or to borrow your phrase, join us, won't you?
Thanks for having me.
The episode in your podcast series on Charles Manson appeared in May this year, just 2 days before the NBC TV series Aquarius began, which stars David Duchovny as a detective on the trail of Charles Manson. Was this a coincidence?
Well, I had actually been planning this series for about 9 months, but when I found out that the David Duchovny show was happening, I did hope that perhaps people who were watching it would find my podcast somehow.
It does provide evidence of the cultural legacy of Charles Manson and the family, for better or worse. Listening to your podcast, though, I had a rather unnerving experience. I felt myself being drawn in, perhaps under his influence, because as well as a dangerous, murderous psychopath, Charles Manson is also strangely, hypnotically charismatic. How did you feel entering the world of Charles Manson and the family so deeply?
I have to say it's been a dark time. not just reading about the murders themselves, but reading about things like the way that Manson did get into the heads of his followers and the different tactics he used, borrowing from other sort of schools of thought like Dale Carnegie and his How to Win Friends and Influence People, and Scientology and even Christianity. Just basically, Manson would take what he thought he could use from all of these different things and use them to get inside the heads of these, you know, usually runaways, kids. A lot of them were young women who had no self-esteem, and Manson convinced them that he loved them and that he was the only one who loved them and that they needed to show their love by doing everything he said.
Yeah, he's immensely powerful on a personal level, even, well, not just women, men as well, very drawn to him. Somehow he managed to figure out what it was that people, well, I'm saying in the past tense, I mean, he's still in a jail aged 80 and still seemingly up to his old tricks. But he's able to get into somebody's head, figure out what they need or want as gratifying, and provide it somehow.
Yeah, and he would often do this thing where he would figure out what he, Charles Manson, wanted, and then he would figure out how to put that idea in somebody else's head so the other person would think it was what they wanted, and then they would make it happen.
It's terrifyingly clever. Now, far from a straight-up biography, what you're doing in this series is really a kind of cultural anthropology. It's about how Charles Manson and his story weaves in and out of popular culture. But it's hard to know which way the influence was stronger. I mean, there's no doubt he was influenced by the culture around him and the kaleidoscope of things, as you say, from Dale Carnegie and Scientology to the Beatles. Mm-hmm. What has been his influence on culture?
Well, I think that he sort of still stands up as being this preeminent American symbol of what evil is. I mean, personally, my point of view on Manson is that he's not evil incarnate. He's just a con man. He was a very good con man who was able to con people into doing really terrible things on his behalf. But I think that you give him too much credit when you refer to him as being this dark emissary from an occult space that we can't really understand. He was just a criminal.
Mm-hmm. And yet there's been how many books written about him, a couple of movies, this Aquarius series that we're talking about now. Is it us that invests him with that power?
I do think that he remains fascinating. I was drawn to this story because my podcast is usually about stories from Hollywood's history that people have either forgotten or that they think that they know, but they don't really know all the details of. And I was drawn to telling Charles Manson's story through that lens because there are so many ways in which he was emblematic of the culture that he was part of and also played a role in the changing of the guard from the 1960s, which was this time of optimism and the sense that things were opening up and there were going to be more freedoms and more things were possible, to the 1970s, which at least in America was a time of great paranoia and distrust. And in terms of the way that Hollywood played a role in sort of reflecting that and making that a real thing that people were able to see as being tangible and part of the culture, I think that the Manson murders played a big role in changing people's sort of points of view.
Yeah, you paint him as a kind of bridge between the 60s and the 70s in a way. And chillingly, you say he described himself at some point as the gardener because, what was it, he picked all the
flowers? Because he tended to all of the lost flower children in San Francisco. Yeah.
But it was a case of time and place. He was...
Yeah, he was a really incredible opportunist. And so when he was released from jail in 1967 and found himself in San Francisco and found so many people who were kind of in search of guidance, he really, you know, with great charisma, stepped in to fill that void.
And the people that you detail him coming across is just a cavalcade of familiar names, from Doris Day and Candice Bergen to, well, Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys, who played a big role. He liked fame. He was drawn to it.
Yes, he was very attracted to it, yeah. I do think that that was what he was after all along. You know, the family was a way of him sort of being the center of attention, but he wanted the attention of the world.
Your podcast outlines some of the very grisly details of the murders. In the very first one, it's almost what you've done is sort of laid out what the known facts are, and then you've gone back and filled in his life story from birth to where he is now. What sort of editorial decisions were you making about how and why to do that?
Well, when I decided to do this series, the story that sparked my interest and made me think that there were a lot of Hollywood stories to tell here was learning about Terry Melcher, who is the son of Doris Day. He was a record producer, sort of, you know, one of the kings of this kind of new Hollywood scene in the late 1960s. He was the boyfriend of Candice Bergen. And he really thought that when Manson's family went and killed Sharon Tate and his friends, Terry Melcher thought that they were looking for him that night. And that was so interesting to me. And so, you know, just the idea that you could draw a direct line from Doris Day to Charles Manson. And so I started looking for other stories that were, you know, kind of like that, where Manson had some kind of connection to somebody else who is known for something else in the culture, whether it's music or movies. I mean, as we speak right now, there's still going to be 5 or 6 more episodes, you know, detailing the lives of people like Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski, and even John Waters, who was a young filmmaker getting ready to make Pink Flamingos during the time of the Charles Manson trial. And he was so fascinated with Manson and his family that he attended the trial.
Manson himself said at one point, in your podcast, you point this out, that the Hate Street area was getting so dangerous at the end of the 60s that it was time to move on. And in a way, he was kind of right, except that the people who he drafted into the family were going out of the frying pan into the fire. What was going on culturally around those, well, progressive hotspots at the time?
Well, the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco was kind of the first place that these young runaways, these hippies started kind of leaving home and flocking to, because there was a promise of being able to live without sort of society's old-fashioned rules. And what that meant in practice usually, ultimately, was that people were homeless or, you know, living in big communes without a lot of food. And it started out as kind of a peace and love thing, free love, often free drugs. But, you know, the drugs started out as pot and LSD and things that were going to mellow you out and expand your mind. And then drug dealers kind of saw an opportunity and started bringing in things like methamphetamine and heroin. And so ultimately, you know, even by the summer of love, supposedly 1967, but especially after that, the Haight-Ashbury scene, you know, it was overcrowded. There was not enough food to go around. And you had just these runaways who had come thinking that they were going to get an answer there. And more often than not, they found themselves with unwanted pregnancies, with diseases, with drug habits that were really destructive. And so this was the scene that Charles Manson saw and was like, this is too dark for me. And he moved with his family, which was then, I think, only about 4 or 5 people. I think he had 4 women with him and 1 man. They got in a school bus that he acquired, and they kind of drove all around the desert and, you know, tried out a few other places, but they ultimately settled in the Topanga Canyon area of Los Angeles, which was becoming its own kind of enclave for people who were searching for something. He found that he wasn't the only guru in Topanga Canyon. There were quite a lot of people who had their own sort of versions of different types of philosophies, and they were taking advantage of the fact that, like, a lot of young people and also celebrities, people with money, people who were just, there were just a lot of people around who were looking for an answer. And then people like Manson stepped in to, you know, try to give it to them.
As you say, your podcast series isn't over, and neither is the story yet. The last we heard of Charles Manson was at the age of 80 in California's Corcoran State Prison. He became engaged to a 26-year-old, Afton Elaine Starr Burton. What was that about?
You know, I think there are conflicting reports as to what that is about. I heard one story that said that this woman who goes by the, like, she calls herself Starr, that she had made a deal with somebody else so that she could marry Manson and then she would have the right to his corpse when he died and then she could take the corpse on tour. And she says that's not true. She says she really loves him.
Oh.
So perhaps both things are true.
Yes.
With, in fact, with Charlie Manson and, you know, with a lot of the stories I talk about on my podcast, often multiple things can coexist.
On RN, we're talking with Karina Longworth. She's the brain behind a podcast called You Must Remember This. She's currently rolling out a series about Charles Manson's Hollywood. But previously, the podcast has concerned itself with the secret and sometimes forgotten stories of Hollywood's first century. Karina, how did you come to be so immersed in these lives?
I grew up in Los Angeles. It just seemed normal when I was growing up to, like, be obsessed with the movies. And then I went to graduate school to get a master's degree in cinema studies, which is where I really started focusing on this time period that people call classical Hollywood, which is sort of loosely defined as the beginning of the sound era up through maybe the 1950s. And, you know, I'm endlessly surprised by how many stories there are about people that you think that you know well, like Katharine Hepburn, Audrey Hepburn, Humphrey Bogart, but people don't know the full story. They remember these images in their heads, like the image of Humphrey Bogart in the hat and the coat and, you know, here's looking at you, kid. But they don't really know much about what his life was like and how his persona on screen was a reflection of a time period and what America was going through during that period.
Yes, the Humphrey Bogart story particularly moved me. I think we always associate him with the end of his life and Lauren Bacall, but in fact he'd been married a number of times before, often being beaten up by one of his wives, turning up on set, having had drinking competitions with her through the night. And if he gave up or fell asleep, she would beat him up even more.
Yeah. He was stuck in a pretty terrible marriage when he met Lauren Bacall. And I do believe that they had a great love story, but it wasn't all smooth sailing.
Mm. That's just one of the myriad of amazing stories that you unfold. One of my other favourites is the one of John Barrymore's corpse being propped up in Errol Flynn's living room.
Yeah, that's a story that's been told a couple of different ways by different people, and then some people say it didn't happen, but Barrymore and Errol Flynn were drinking buddies, and depending on who you talk to, some people say it was Peter Lorre, some people say it was Bogart, a few other names have been thrown in there, but the rumor is that somebody paid off the funeral home immediately after John Barrymore died, and arranged to have John Barrymore's embalmed corpse waiting for Errol Flynn in his home bar when he came home from the studio one night.
Which was apparently pretty much like standard form for Barrymore.
Yeah.
Well, we look forward to hearing the end of your Charles Manson's Hollywood series, Karina, and eagerly anticipate your next podcast series. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Karina Longworth is author of 4 books on film history, and we'll put a link to her podcast, You Must Remember This, on the List's program page. Well, that's the List for today. I'm Cassie McCullough. I hope you're enjoying your RN summer.